In the coming week, President Biden delivers the last State of the Union of his current term. Iran holds elections for its parliament and assembly of experts, and Bosnia and Herzegovina marks Independence Day while enmeshed in a gas pipeline feud. It's February 29th, 2024, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Carly Ann Robbins.
Carly, I don't get to say this that often, but happy Leap Day.
Nobody gets to say this very often.
No. And happy birthday to those who have that, you know, quadrennial birthday celebration on this day, by the way. But let's start here in Washington, where President Biden's State of the Union address is scheduled for next Thursday. As we went to tape this podcast, Carla, lawmakers appeared to have put off an immediate government shutdown, but deep divisions certainly remain. And also, as we were taping this podcast, both President Biden and former President Trump were making competing visits to the U.S. border with Mexico. So how to judge the State of the Union at this point, Carla?
So, Bob, you know, we're professional writers, and I am always amazed at this task confronting State of the Union speechwriters, the jockeying inside the administration and out to get the president to talk about what they want him to talk about is always really intense. You know, are you going to highlight my favorite program? Are you going to pitch, you know, yourself in a specific way? And this year, the tension has just got to be off the charts because you got a presidential campaign. You've just got multitude of fast-moving domestic and international crises. I mean, today we have this awful massacre in Gaza versus the fact of this question whether there's going to be a ceasefire in Gaza before he speaks. You've got the chaos in Washington policymaking or not policymaking. You know, any drafts that are written today are inevitably going to have to be drafted and redrafted and redrafted and redrafted probably until the very last moment. The president's aides who are most focused on the election, which I pretty much guess is everybody, are hoping to use this speech to highlight Biden's vigor and wit and possibly his Irish temper as a way to dispel concerns, including among Democrats, about his age. The White House has really worked hard to beat back that special counsel's report that described him as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. And he did a great job last year. You know, he really boxed the Republicans in. He, you know, went off script in a really great way. And they're really hoping for another performance like that. But the Republicans aren't going to let that special counsel report go. And Robert Hur, the special counsel, is scheduled to testify before the House Judiciary Committee 5 days after the State of the Union. So that's going to be a really big focus, is just really just the performance nature of it. As for the substance, well, we're going to see where we stand on the budget battles and whether Biden approaches this as a uniter or uses it to highlight GOP dysfunction. The vote on the first tranche, the thing that they seem to have made a deal on, is the day after the State of the Union. And if it looks like it's going well, maybe he will be the uniter. But he's got another deadline, the 22nd, so just a few weeks after this. And, you know, that's up in the air, which is why they're going to be drafting and redrafting what is going to be his tack on the budget fights. Unless there's a breakthrough, he's certainly going to be making a big push on Ukraine funding. And inevitably, he's going to take another run at Trump's invitation to Russia to invade some of America's closest allies. And I wouldn't be surprised if he reprised what is this extraordinary line from a few weeks back when he declared that, quote, no other president in history has ever bowed down to a Russian dictator. Let me say this as clearly as I can. I never will. For God's sake, it's shameful. It's dangerous. It's un-American. I mean, that's about as strong a statement. And I think you're going to hear something just like that in the speech. Putin's threat today, you know, in his own version of the State of the Union, that Russia could use nuclear weapons if the West sent troops, is almost certainly going to have to draw some sort of response. And I think that's going to be, you know, sort of central to the State of the Union. I, Joe Biden, am standing up to Russia, and Donald Trump is not. He's going to have to showcase a laundry list of domestic accomplishments, high employment, a drop in inflation. Although I think there's going to have to be a lot more empathy, because I don't think Americans still yet feel this drop of inflation. And then, of course, the border, as you mentioned. We'll see what he says on his visit today, highlighting the fact that the Republicans could have had an immigration deal, pushing the GOP into taking yes on an immigration deal when Trump told them to be no. I think that's also going to be a big focus for the State of the Union.
It's quite a lineup that you just went through, Carla. And you're right. For all the angst over the scripted points of the speech, it's the unscripted moments that sometimes get outsized tension as well. And both will be watched closely. You can't overestimate, you know, what's at stake in a lot of ways. It's called a very political speech in a lot of ways, and it certainly is. But it's also, it is an important speech for the country to hear. There are very few single moments where Americans gather around anything. And it's not like they're going to gather around like the Super Bowl to watch the State of the Union. However, there are reactions.
Unless Taylor Swift comes. Well, do you think Taylor Swift is going to be there?
Well, that's an interesting point there. There have been some hunches that potentially there'll be some other special guests showing up that'll get attention, potentially the widow of Alexei Navalny. We'll see. But this is going to be an important point on these areas that you mentioned. You know, we tend to look through the foreign policy lens, certainly. But really, the State of the Union has a through line to foreign policy. And so all this is going to be at stake in this speech. And the entire week is going to be really packed, Carla. So we're in for a particularly intense week of politicking and maybe some policy in the process.
So the other thing that is going to be a big focus in this is going to be reproductive rights. And that's going to get an enormous amount of focus. And we always focus on who are going to be the guests. And the first guest we heard about is Kate Cox from Dallas. And she's the woman who sued the state of Texas to terminate her non-viable pregnancy, and she's the first adult to do so since Roe v. Wade. And this whole question of IVF, which the Republicans have been really roiling about since this Alabama court ruling. And I think, you know, as you said, a big through line of this is going to be this notion that the Republicans are extreme and that Congress won't pass a bill protecting IVF. And I think whether it's on domestic issues or on international issues, it's going to be, why won't you take yes for a reasonable answer? And so we'll see this in the guests they invite. We'll see this in the speech. But in the end of the day, his delivery is probably going to get more of a focus than anything else.
Yeah. And it is among the many subplots to look for is the extent to which both parties are united or not in their various responses to themes. The Republicans, as has been said repeatedly, are really divided on foreign policy issues. It is a fairly small group that has been blocking a deal on Ukraine aid. And yet, when Biden references Ukraine and support for Ukraine, it's going to be very interesting to see what the Republican response is, both from Senate and the House side. Just as one example, and yeah, IVF is another issue that has a lot more delineations than some of the other policy issues. So yeah, it's going to be a temperature taking of parties and of atmospherics and, as you say, of the president's own capabilities. He just had a physical the other day. It seemed to be no major issues, but presidential physicals aren't necessarily great revealers, as we've learned in recent history.
So on Ukraine, the National Security Advisor was on the shows on Sunday, and he talked about how he had spoken with Speaker Johnson about it. And he claimed that Johnson said he wanted to pass the Ukraine funding. And it was really interesting that Sullivan talked about how one person can bend the course of history. And he said, right now, it comes down to his willingness to actually step up to the plate and discharge his responsibility, and history is watching. It's really interesting, that pitch that they're giving to him. And we might hear that from Biden as well, that history is watching what we do in Ukraine. So a lot to watch there, and we'll see what the response is from got more people screaming out liar.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the loss of norms as well. So lots to watch there. So, Bob, let's shift to Iran. Tomorrow, Iranians are going to elect new members to their parliament and the Assembly of Experts, and that's the body that will at some point in the next few years choose a new supreme leader. And they do that from within their own ranks. And this is the first election since protests broke out in September of 22 over the death in custody of Mahsa Amini. You know, everyone's saying, go out and vote. All the leaders are saying, go out and vote. But Iranians seem pretty disillusioned with their government. What are you looking for in these elections?
Well, I'm not looking for change, Carla. I think, first of all, it's important to point out, as you said, it's the first vote since the death of Mahsa Amini, which triggered extraordinary protests, so extraordinary that some seasoned Iran watchers said this could really be a game changer, and yet it wasn't. But even before that set of incidents happened in 2022, there was an election in the 2020 parliamentary elections and 2021 presidential vote in which really low turnout, I mean, embarrassingly low turnout. There seems to be a ever-growing rift between the ruling clerics, the ruling and aging clerics, and the young population. Iran has incredibly young population who don't have much prospect for a future given the state of the economy, given the state of the clerics, the corruption, the sort of grip on all of the power chambers. And so we should note that the crackdown that happened after the Mahsa Amini protests resulted in something like 500 protesters killed. There were thousands were arrested. The country continues to execute prisoners at one of the highest rates in the world. And it's among the reasons, including its ongoing nuclear program, that it faces sanctions. Iran and Russia are the most sanctioned countries in the world. And so that has obviously had a strong effect on its, much more of an effect on its economy seemingly than Russia's, although Iranian energy still seems to get out into certain markets, including to China. But I'll focus on the Assembly of Experts first, because this is, as you said, the body whose main task is to choose the next supreme leader. Ayatollah Khamenei is 84, going to be 85 in April. He's been said to be ailing for years. So this is seen to be the election that will pick the next leader. Reportedly, there are already intense discussions going on behind closed doors in Iran about who will succeed the supreme leader. It has been bandied about that the current president, Raisi, might be among those who are candidates. Or Khamenei's son, his name is surfaced as candidate. He's been the supreme leader since 89, and he's, you know, ruled deftly if you consider the way he's been able to hold on to power, play power centers against each other. And now you have in Iran, again, this very conservative aligned presidency, parliament, judiciary. He has the Iranian Revolutionary Guard force that reports directly to him, the supreme leader. And so he's lined up things in which seemingly no, let's say, pragmatist forces. Pragmatist is a term that in Iran means something different than maybe other places, but at the very least, it means not the hardcore conservative line. But even that is being affected. The former president Hassan Rouhani, who's considered a moderate in the Iranian context, was actually disqualified from running again in the Assembly of Experts vote. So he had been serving on it for a number of years, and he's protested that. But it's seeming like they're trying to, you know, stack the deck so that there are conservatives who will walk in lockstep with whatever the supreme leader wants in terms of a succession plan, and then that that happen as smoothly as possible. So that's a long-winded way of saying to your question, Carl, that I don't expect any changes, and I think we should just be looking to see which individuals might emerge from these elections in any sort of extra prominence, and that those are the ones we should start focusing on in the rundown to the new supreme leader.
So in this parliamentary election, there's just a huge number of candidates.
Yes. One of the things that experts are saying is that they deliberately allowed an extra amount of candidates in there to try to show, you know, some sort of way of, you know, countering this sense that they are aloof and out of touch with the people, that they're going to allow more people to run, professionals,
what is
independents.
It like 15,000?
15,000 for 290 seats, yeah. So they're going to be, you know, a lot of professionals. You got doctors, you've had teachers, you've got engineers, you've got 1,700 women approved to run as candidates. But let's be clear, these are people who have been heavily vetted, and you're not going to see, at least on the surface, they're pretty confident you're going to have a group of conservative people coming into office. There's always surprises, even in Iran's system. They feel like they need to hold these elections for the sake of legitimacy. But even with the broad field of candidates running in the parliament, just the die seems to be cast for a consolidation of conservative forces in Iran. And the parliament's abilities are circumscribed in other ways, too, especially by the Council of Guardians, which is a group of jurists that help vet the parliament.
It's an interesting notion. If you have 15,000 candidates for 290 seats, I mean, there are two ways of looking at that, I suppose, that lots of people get to participate in the process, even though nobody gets to run unless they are vetted and agreed that by the powers that be that they can run in the first place.
Right. We should note that 15,000 came out of 49,000 who had put their bid in. So they approved 15 out of 49,000 who had sought to run.
Are there 49,000 people who believe in the system, or they're tweaking the system or challenging it? It's interesting why you would throw your name in the first place. But 15,000 candidates for 290 seats, does that mean more participatory democracy, or does it mean less? Because you're so overwhelmed by this. How can you possibly make a rational choice when you go in to vote? How could you possibly know who they are, what they stand for, what they could possibly deliver? Someplace like New York City, where I live, and I think, and I sat on an editorial board where we made endorsements for a long time, most people say, you know, who's my assembly member? Who's, you know, who's my state senator? You know, all of these candidates. I mean, do people even read the list? I mean, this is an overwhelming number.
Yeah. Again, many Iran watchers just say it is for show. There's one I follow at the Middle East Institute, Alex Fatanka, who basically said these elections are set to break records for pointlessness because of the way it's been engineered and because he expects voter turnout to be particularly low. So It is a lot for show. And again, it does indicate that the regime is interested in having turnout. Turnout is the one number to look for, I guess, in this election. The supreme leader himself has talked about it, you know, it being a jihad to vote. That's important for the Iranians to express their will and vote for these candidates, you know, who have been carefully selected. And they will be sure to blame low turnout against Western or opposition forces or other nefarious outside actors who are against the will of the Iranian people. So it's part of the stage-managed approach, somewhat similar to what we'll see in a different context in Russia in a couple of weeks too, Carla.
And because leading opposition figures have called for a boycott of the vote as the only way that you can really express your dissent. And, you know, there are some really incredibly grim numbers here. I mean, more than 600 prisoners have been executed in response to the Mahsa Amini protests. And, you know, 20,000 people were arrested originally. More than 500 people were killed during the protests. We got lots of people running for this, but the fundamental repression of this government is cannot be denied.
Exactly. I mean, the one critic you'll see from some Iran watchers is that this opposition continues to just not be organized in any effective way. Now, whether it's you're talking about diaspora Iranians or anybody who are still inside the country, it's pretty difficult to form any sort of organized structures given the numbers you just cited. By the way, those Mahsa Amini protests were not well organized. It was a real spontaneous outpouring of outrage, which is, again, why a number of experts had thought that maybe something different was happening. So, again, elections do have consequences, even bogus ones. And so we'll take a look and see what happens in the course of the next several days because the elections are taking place soon. All right, Carla. Well, speaking of fraught situations, let's go to the Balkans, shall we? Tomorrow, Bosnia and Herzegovina marks 32 years of independence from Yugoslavia. Bosnia and Herzegovina does remain caught up in geopolitical feuds, however, and Bosnia and Herzegovina itself is not a unified state in any fashion. The latest feud, though, involves gas, as in a gas pipeline. The country, at the moment, has been dependent on Russia for its natural gas supplies. The United States and European Union leaders have been pushing to try to minimize that influence by installing a U.S.-funded natural gas pipeline running from Croatia, a NATO member. This plan has roadblocks and has spurred a number of squabbles in the country. So can you tell us a bit about what's stopping the pipeline from going forward?
So first, we need to give credit to Andy Higgins in the New York Times, who really wrote a great piece about this. And there was a time in my life when Bosnia was all I thought about, because in the early 90s, when the unraveling of the Soviet bloc, it was a major focus of U.S. policy during the Clinton administration. And it was a major test also of NATO. This was the first conflict, at the end of the Cold War, that NATO had to decide whether or not it was going to get involved in.
And a dark moment of U.N. peacekeeping as well, we should note.
And an incredible test that the EU failed as well. We were reminded why we needed NATO in a very small way by comparison with what's going on in the world right then. But it really was sort of the first post-Cold War test for NATO. This celebration here, such it is celebrating the independence of the Republic of Bosnia and Herzegovina from Yugoslavia. In 1992 was also the start of this incredibly bloody Bosnia war, Srebrenica massacres, terrible things that happened there. And it was finally brought to an end with NATO bombing, U.S. and European sanctions, of course, the Dayton Peace Accords. And what happened afterwards, nearly 30 years later, this agreement that was negotiated, really, it brought an end to the killing, but it didn't bring an end to the profound ethnic feuding. And in part of that is a structural problem because they divided up all the institutions among the three ethnic groups there, including this presidency. They have this tripartite presidency.
This is the process that ended the war, right? This is the Dayton Accords that put this in place.
With the expectation that they would get past it someday.
Right, right.
And instead, these structures are still in place there, and everybody focuses on this is Croat, this is Bosniak Muslim, this is Serb. And instead of having an integrated society, they have a completely ethnically divided society and institutionally divided society. And they have not gone past really that original moment. I think there's a really interesting lesson here, and I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I think structures matter. I think that these structures were not sunsetted, and they're still living it, and they're living it in Kosovo. Kosovo has not gotten past it either. And so while, you know, we can celebrate the diplomacy of Dayton, they haven't grown past it. And that's, you know, and you can blame Serbia next door. You can talk about whether Europe hasn't done more to reintegrate it. You can talk about Russian meddling. There's lots of reasons why it's happened. But these divisions, sadly, and divisions that really didn't exist before the breakup of Yugoslavia, all of which are, there's a lot of tragedy in here.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's back to the gas pipeline. Let's be clear that gas is only about 5% of Bosnia's energy sources. It gets most of its power from hydro and, unfortunately, from burning coal. But gas does heat the capital of Sarajevo in winter, and Russia is its sole gas supplier. And we've seen what Moscow does when it's the sole supplier of gas. It uses energy as a political bribe, and it uses it as a political weapon, which is why the U.S. and the Europeans have been pushing Bosnia to wean itself from the Russians and offering this pipeline, which through Croatia, and Croatia, let's remember, is a NATO and an EU member. It's a comparatively small project. It's about 100 mile long, cost a little bit over $100 million. But the project hasn't gone anywhere because these three ethnic groups can't agree on who's going to run it, where it's going to be, all the typical things that you would see, you know, in a country that's so ethnically divided. The Serb president, you know, who heads the Republic of Srpska, Bosnia is divided fundamentally between the Republic of Srpska and then this shared Bosnian Croat section. He's a big friend of Putin's. He's in and out of Russia all the time. He was there this week as well. He's completely opposed to the project. You know, he wants more Russian pipelines. He's championing a particular additional pipeline from Russia. The ethnic Croat leader supports the pipeline from Croatia, not surprisingly, but he wants it to be run by a company run by ethnic Croats. And the Bosniak Muslim leader wants the project to remain, surprise, surprise, under the current pipeline operator, which is based in Sarajevo and run by the Bosniak Muslims. So does this matter transcendently in geopolitical terms? No. What I think the thing that fascinated me about this story is that it's just a reminder of how profoundly divided this country is. The U.S. thinks it matters because they certainly don't want, you know, Russia peeling off more countries into its web. They certainly would like to anchor all of the Balkans in the West. And Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Jim O'Brien, who was hugely involved in ending the Bosnia War at the time, went to Sarajevo this month as a part of this effort to, you know, break the stalemate. I don't know how much progress he made. Tony Blinken's been sending letters to people trying to break the stalemate. But so far, the stalemate continues.
You know, it had been thought that there's been so much carrot and stick involved in Bosnia since its independence, seemingly. And I recall covering a lot of these issues at the United Nations because there's this UN stewardship of overseeing the international agreement that was, you know, allowing the country to function, including, by the way, that there was a time, I'm not sure how it is now, but in the early 2000s, the UN ambassador from Bosnia was a Muslim and his deputy was always a Serb. And there was Mo Shakirbi was the ambassador at the time.
Mo Shakirbi, I've absolutely
yeah,
remember him.
Yeah,
yes.
Who's a real, you know, real larger than life character. And his deputy was a Serb and a proud Serb, but they both had made common cause to represent Bosnia. It was an interesting experiment. And there was a little bit of hopefulness at the time. But I say that to just to say that part of that was also part of the bigger experiment of can this fragmented country survive? And there were carrots that were offered too. And I'm wondering, it just seems like the enormous carrot of growing EU ties just does not seem to be enough anymore. That's the ethnic or the civilizational pull that seems to be, you know, winning the day there. But are you seeing any sort of incentives to help them overcome this impasse?
Well, the EU accepted Bosnia as a candidate country in 22, but they haven't begun formal negotiations. And, you know, the country has a lot of corruption, hasn't done a lot of the reforms. And this has been the process itself for a lot of these countries. You know, Serbia didn't want to give up its war criminals until it was pushed really hard by the EU, which is how they finally got the war criminals from Srpska. It took mm-hmm. them, you know, forever, I don't know, right. 15, 17, how many years it took.
And many, by the way, still don't acknowledge Srebrenica as a massacre too, which is many people don't.
This was the huge debate in the 90s about it, this whole question of whether it was inevitably bred in the bone, these sort of ethnic conflicts. I do not believe that as a person. And this is why Clinton, you know, hesitated so long to get involved, because he had all these people saying these people are inevitably are condemned to fight each other
right.
forever. For the other people who said, no, there was a long time when Sarajevo was this glorious multi-ethnic city. Serbs married Croats, Croats married Bosniaks. You know, we, who are we to say this? And you see this debate now over creating a two-state solution, the ability of Palestinians and Israelis to live side by side versus other people saying they're condemned to kill each other forever. I am a person who believes people can live together. Maybe they're not going to be holding hands and singing Kumbaya, but people can live together.
Well, and we look cautiously at Northern Ireland as a possible example of that. So, but there are other examples, so you're right.
You know, that has been the incentive, certainly, of the EU, and certainly it was also the incentive when NATO was enlarging itself. It's, you know, saying to countries, resolve your border differences if you want to join NATO. This was the project at the end of the Cold War to try to stabilize Europe. And to a certain extent, it succeeded, but it's a project that's incomplete, and we still have the, you know, the remnants of the Dayton Accords in Bosnia. It's very much an unresolved, and the Russians are certainly seeking to take advantage of it right now, and Ukraine has only made it more fraught. So, Bob, time to discuss our audience figure of the week. And this is the figure listeners vote on every Tuesday and Wednesday at CFR_org's Instagram story. And this week, our audience selected Sweden becomes the 32nd NATO member. So Putin wanted less NATO when he started the war in Ukraine, and now he has a lot more. So how much does Sweden add to the strength of the alliance?
Well, let me first start out by referencing the Putin comments that you cited earlier today, because they're very much an important part of this. He used this opportunity of this regularly scheduled speech to weigh in and to try to seize the narrative, because the NATO growth is a big loss, and it's a big strike against Putin's whole calculus for invading Ukraine. But there was some ill-timed, ill-advised comments, perhaps by Emmanuel Macron earlier this week, about boots on the ground coming in to help in Ukrainian cause. And Putin responded by taking on directly and resurfacing these ominous nuclear threats that he had made earlier after the 2022 invasion. He said, quote, "They need to understand that we too have weapons," and added, "that can strike targets on their territory. And everything that they're thinking of now, everything that they use to threaten us, all this is a real threat of nuclear weapons being used, which spelled destruction of civilization," end quote. So he's laying it all out there, and it has created this chilling effect. There were, by the way, we should note, other NATO members, other countries in the alliance, you know, tried to walk back any sense of NATO forces joining on the ground in Ukraine. We should also mention there are plenty of mercenaries from NATO countries and other places who are fighting alongside Ukrainians, as there are on the Russian side too. But this is a formal NATO versus Russia thing that is very ominous. Back to your original question, Sweden as a 32nd member brings tremendous capabilities. First of all, if you look at the map, when you couple Sweden and Finland together, you've basically have this, you know, unbroken line against Russia now from the Baltic Sea down through Central Europe. Swedes have for years maintained a strong military, even while maintaining neutrality. It does not mean they have pulled the plug on their defense capabilities. And they've also, by the way, trained with NATO countries. They have interoperability. They are going to be close to be meeting that 2% of GDP defense spending that has been a NATO commitment. They are already there, reportedly. They have strong air defenses and other capabilities that I think NATO is happy to see. We should note, apparently, the final step that helped Hungary step over the line and support their accession was a deal for fighter jets, for Swedish fighter jets, that was sealed earlier this week. And so they had previously faced problems and blocking from Turkey. Turkey also was able to get some concessions, including, you know, a vow to introduce new anti-terror laws and directed at Kurdish groups and so forth. So Sweden brings capability, and they also bring a newfound resolve that Russia hadn't faced before from Scandinavia. And I think that's going to be very important. It's also going to be important now. Any sort of messaging coming out of NATO is going to be super important as they try to dial down the temperature at the moment.
It is an extraordinary thing that, you know, who would have thought Sweden, sort of seen as this partisan of neutrality, being throwing its lot so completely in response to this invasion of Ukraine, and particularly at a time when the U.S. is going all wobbly, or threatening to go all wobbly under Donald Trump. It is a very much a shifting world out there, and 32 members of NATO, and certainly NATO a lot stronger, and we'll see whether NATO can hold. We'll see what happens in the election.
Yeah, and, you know, again, this is a country that its neutrality was part of its identity in some ways. And you had you know, many well-known international envoys and arms experts and others tended to be Swedish because they carried this credibility of being a neutral actor. But even Sweden has just sort of reached a point, given what they've seen in playing out in Ukraine, where it's time to join the alliance. As you say, very interesting times as we walk into a year in which NATO is marking 75 years as an alliance. And that's our look at the world next week, Carla. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. China's Communist Party lays out its 2024 policies at the annual Two Sessions Conference. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni visits Canada. And Art Dubai, one of the Mideast's leading international art fairs, kicks off.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. We appreciate the feedback. If you'd like to reach us, please email us at twnw@cfr.org. The publications mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on cfr.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the host, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Esther Fank and Sunetta Deuce, with Director of Podcasting Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia recorded and edited this episode. Special thanks to our intern Olivia Green for her research assistance. Our theme music is provided by Marcus Zacharia. He's everywhere. This is Carla Robbins saying so long.
And this is Bob McMahon saying goodbye, and be careful out there.